There will come a day in this economy, I promise you, when the monthly jobs report is not the be-all and end-all. Sadly, though, that day is not today. It is Jobs Day Friday, everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 8th of May. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Also with us right now, since it is Friday, as I believe I've mentioned once or twice, are John Carney from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Redfin. It's a little thing we do called the Weekly Wrap. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai. Hi, Kai.
All right, John. So quickly, I guess, because, I'll let you tell me. I think it's all good news, this jobs report. 223,000 new jobs, 5.4% on the rate. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It's not all good news.
Oh, man, Carney, you're killing me, man.
They had to take down March's number to a really low level, and that means that it really describes just how bad things got in the first quarter and thus how fragile our economy is. There was no big event that ruined everything in March, but yet we only added 85,000 jobs.
No big event except like 14 feet of snow, John. Come on.
There was a lot of snow, particularly on the East Coast, but it still means that, you know, our economy shouldn't collapse just because we get a bit of bad weather.
All right, Neela, help me out here. I'm still in the this report is good news camp. You?
I think it's like eating a donut without sugar. You know immediately something's missing.
I don't think you can do that.
Until we see some wage growth, it's not going to be a good jobs report. Wages are barely keeping up with inflation. So even though the economy is adding jobs this month, until wages grow, that's not going to be as meaningful as it needs to be for the economy.
Am I misguided then, Neela, in looking for good news in good numbers?
You're a good person. You should. But there's still a missing ingredient, and that's all wages. Right. Seems like there's so many people who are working part-time who want to work full-time that they're more interested in more hours than more pay, and it still hasn't happened yet.
All right, fair enough. There's other stuff to talk about, so we will move on. John, I want to talk about Janet Yellen. She is, as you know, the chair of the Fed. She said in a conversation with Christine Lagarde, the managing director of the IMF this week, she said, as she has not actually come out and said before, she believes stock values are, and this is a quote, quite high. My mind went immediately to Alan Greenspan and irrational exuberance. What did you think?
I was rooting for her to actually say irrational exuberance.
Right? Yeah.
It was one of the more interesting things about that, however, is it didn't immediately tank the market
as
a lot of people thought, which makes you wonder either do people not believe, not really care what Janet Yellen thinks about the stock market in the way that they used to about Alan Greenspan.
Greenspan and Bernanke, yeah.
Yeah, or maybe maybe the idea is just that, things aren't as high as they seem.
Wow.
Because if you can't, when the Fed chairman, calling the stock market out as getting, irrationally exuberant or, quite high, doesn't tank the market, that tells you something.
Neela, what do you think about Janet Yellen and what she is thinking now, right? Because it's all about rates and this and that. And she looks at the stock market now and says publicly for the first time, ooh, it's quite high.
I had a different take than John. I thought she was stating the obvious. I thought we knew for a while that the stock market has been feeding off this low interest rate policy.
But
that they were excited and rallied on the fact that this was a lukewarm job report, which means that rate hike could be pushed out even further, I think is evidence that, there's some credibility into what Janet Yellen is saying.
But you know what? Fed people are never supposed to say what they actually think, right?
So, I know. And she's coming the closest of any chairperson I've ever seen. So that's probably what's taking the market by surprise.
All right. Item three on today's discussion list, John, is the election over in the UK. Interesting surprise for the Conservatives. It leads me to this question. Which will happen first? A Brexit, that is Great Britain leaving the Eurozone as the referendum will be held in 2017, or a Grexit, Greece leaving the Eurozone?
Brexit is still far more likely than a Brexit for the simple fact that there's really good cause for Greece to perhaps need to leave the Eurozone. there's no, you know, no matter, I do not believe that the people of the UK are actually going to vote themselves out of the EU. There's no, remember, it's not destroying their economy the way the membership in the Eurozone is destroying Greece's.
Neil, a different question to you to wrap things up. The Senate this week passed a budget plan. Nobody is bound by it. It will change 1,000 times before it gets to the president. I would like, however, to register some trepidation at the idea that the Congress of the United States is going to get back to messing with the economy. You?
I think it's time that the government gets back to work on the economy. We still have some issues that need to be addressed, and only fiscal policy will address them. So I'm happy to see a little bit of collaboration as the summer returns to D.C.
All right. There you go. Neela Richardson from Redfin and John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, guys.
Thank you,
Kyle. Have a good weekend.
All right. You too. Back to the jobs report for just a second. The relevant numbers I touched on, right? 223,000 new jobs, 5.4% on the rate. If you dig into the actual details, the line-by-line items on that thing, there's all kinds of other stuff in there as well. But economists being economists, they say there is plenty more information that they wish they could get out of the thing. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that story.
By many accounts, the monthly jobs report is really the best way we have of measuring what a healthy economy is supposed to deliver, jobs. That being said, Harvard economist Ken Rogoff says they're still just estimates.
They're very volatile. They involve statistical sampling. You know, they're not hard data. There's a lot that they don't pick up.
Justin Wolfers is an economist at the University of Michigan. He says jobs numbers come with a margin of error of 100,000. He wishes the data had more specific information about the quality of jobs being created.
There's good jobs in retail and there's bad jobs in retail. And so knowing a lot more about the details of what types of jobs are being created, I think would be tremendously helpful.
Because the jobs report is just a snapshot in time, economists don't really know where the jobs are coming from. For instance, are they being created by employers on the supply side, or are they just because more people are entering the market? And perhaps most importantly, what are we benchmarking to?
Like, we have the sense, I think, that we're not back to full employment. But we don't exactly know where full employment will land.
Diane Lim is an economist at the Committee for Economic Development.
You know, there are all kinds of things changing at the same time, and economists have always faced this challenge, is that we can never run a perfectly controlled experiment and say, this is the cause because we held all else constant, because we can never hold all else constant.
One thing economists are wrestling with, Lim says, is whether the current good numbers are simply a recovery from recession or part of a longer-term growth trend. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Adam mentioned the margin of error on the payroll number. Here's today's little-known fact. The employment rate comes with built-in wiggle room, too. So this morning's 5.4% is actually 5.4% plus or minus 0.2 percentage point, which I think is interesting. Maybe that's just me. Wall Street Today, yeah, they love the jobs report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced this morning that the Justice Department is going to launch an investigation into the Baltimore Police Department. She called the troubled relationship between some police departments and the communities they serve one of the most challenging issues of our time. At a basic level, a very basic level, being a cop is a job. It's a job that's changing as society changes. So we're going to be spending some time over the next couple of weeks looking at that. Today on our series, Behind the Blue Line, a step back from the headlines about police abuse and a look at what cops say they worry about day in and day out. Here's Sally Herships.
Cop to Cop is a 24-hour hotline for stressed out police officers. It says exposure to trauma, murders, car accidents, hurt kids is the number one worst part of the job. But there's a close number two. Brian Higgins was a cop for 27 years and just retired as chief of police for Bergen County, New Jersey.
What frustrated me was all the other stuff, the administrative baloney.
Higgins says for lots of cops, that administrative baloney is actually number one, not the threat of getting hurt or killed.
Can we draw like a pie chart of the stress? Like, can we do that?
For me personally, the part of the stress of the job, the danger, I think is like this.
That's a tiny sliver.
This is why I got into it. chasing people, getting shot at. I expected this. I wanted this.
What Higgins and many other cops say they don't want is having to deal with the inescapable politics of policing. If you've ever seen the HBO police show, The Wire, you know what he's talking about. The entire series kicks off when a detective named Jimmy McNulty makes his boss look bad by accident. His boss isn't happy.
You see these, McNulty? You see them? These are for you.
Think hand gestures involving a middle finger.
These are for you for as long as it takes me to get even.
Major.
No, don't major me, you backstab.
Take this bad boss and give him an enormous detailed rule book, which he can discipline you with, and you get one of the problems Higgins is talking about.
I had a buddy of mine that jumped into a river for a helicopter that went down, rescued two people, and when the chief showed up, he was asked where his hat was. You know, that's so frustrating. It makes you want to, like, just lash out.
I think the evidence is pretty clear that the sources of stress tend to come mostly from administrative issues internal to the organization.
Robert Kane is director of the Criminology and Justice Studies program at Drexel University. He says in many cases, police officers have far more rules than other professions, and following all of them can make it difficult for officers to do their jobs.
Whether they wear short sleeves or long sleeves in their uniform, the position of their nameplate or their badge. In many police organizations, you know, a lot of these little nitpicky things are called white socks violations.
There are so many rules, Kane says, it's almost impossible to do the job without breaking some, from those little nitpicky things to bigger issues, like when it's okay to pull out your gun or taser or a nightstick. He and Brian Higgins, the cop you heard a minute ago, both told me the problem is so bad, cops have a saying about it.
I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6.
Translation. Police officers would rather risk facing a jury of 12 for breaking a rule than end up at their own funeral carried by 6 pallbearers.
They know they're breaking the rules, but in their minds, it's a rule that's worth breaking, and they're much more willing to risk a rule violation than place themselves at risk.
John Shane was a cop for 16 years, the last 5 as a captain in Newark, New Jersey. And he says he understands that fear. Now he's a professor at John Jay College, and he studies cops and stress. And he says part of that stress comes from the way officers are hired and promoted.
And I certainly watched people get promoted into positions that clearly did not have the knowledge, skills, or abilities to do the job.
Shane says politics are to blame. Often chiefs are appointed, he says, by politicians. So there's pressure. Want to keep your job? You need to keep the politicians happy.
So if we have speeding problems on this street, but on this street you have several council members who might be speeding, you're not going to set up an enforcement operation on that street. You're going to go to another street where no one's likely to complain.
Shane says that expectation of loyalty moves right down the ranks. Captains have to keep chiefs happy, lieutenants captains, and so on. He says that means in problem departments, officers can get hired based on loyalty, not because they're the best candidate for the job. And all of this can make cops lose faith in the system. Shane says this is when ethics can start to slip away.
Because the sentiment is that nobody really cares. Look at the people above me, what they're doing. If they're doing those things, nobody's going to care what I'm doing down here.
Retired Chief Brian Higgins says at the same time, cops have less and less discretion about how they do their jobs, which exacerbates things even further.
Sit in your car, walk your beat, shut your mouth, and only do what the buck allows you. In the business world, you leave your job.
But Higgins says oftentimes police can't. Except for the top jobs like chief, they're stuck. Because of all those complicated loyalties, if you move departments, you have to start all over, from the bottom. He says the current focus on problems with individual officers is ignoring a bigger problem. The system is broken.
You know, if it was a subject who waved the gun around, certain groups would come out and say, they had mental health, why didn't we ask why was he waving the gun? I get that. But there's nobody asking about the cop. You know, why did the cop react this way?
Higgins says more civilians and government officials need to ask that question and recognize there's a bigger problem. All of the stress cops face on the job can drive some of them to drug and alcohol abuse, suicide, and even excessive use of force.
I've heard it for 30 years.
That's Dr. Everly, a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He's a specialist in stress and human resilience, and he's worked with cops for decades. He says they are the thin blue line between chaos and a law-abiding society.
There are few jobs that have those weights in them.
And he says if it sounds shocking or surprising that workplace stress can cause such extreme responses, just think about what stress is, a fight or flight response, and what police do.
In the context of violence, it is predictable that you would escalate the violence.
Back at the cop-to-cop hotline, the phone continues to ring with calls from stressed-out police officers across the country, up to 850 every month. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up. People want to send something of value, and nothing is of more value than it looks great and then you can eat it.
Why send flowers when you can send fruit? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 267 points on this Friday, 1.5%, closed at 18,191. The NASDAQ gained 58 points, 1.1%, ended at 5,003. The S&P 500 added 28 points, 1.3%, 2116. At the bell for the week, the Dow up 0.9%. The NASDAQ was flat. The S&P 500 up 0.4%. The big takeover that wasn't, or at least isn't yet, St. Louis-based ag giant Monsanto offered to buy Swiss-based ag giant Syngenta for 45 billion American simoleons, but was turned down. Monsanto up 1.3% on the news. Syngenta in Swiss trading up 19%. At Bojangles, it's breakfast all day. Chicken and biscuit, sausage and biscuit, egg and cheese biscuit. I could go on, you know. Now you, too, can buy a share of Bojangles. The regional chain went public. Shares quickly fried up 25%. I love my job. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, President Obama will recognize emerging entrepreneurs from the U.S. and around the world. The National Women's History Museum will honor women who have made significant contributions to their field and serve as inspirations. And if you're planning on starting your diet on Monday, consider rescheduling. It's Eat What You Want Day, so wear your stretchy pants. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It looks like we got the makings of a good old-fashioned bidding war on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. The New York Times reported this morning that Uber, the ride-sharing company, has put in what may be a $3 billion bid for a digital mapping business owned by the Finnish telecommunications firm Nokia. Also said to be in the running is a group of German car makers, including Audi and BMW, which are working with the Chinese search engine company Baidu. That is a whole lot of interest in a company that isn't exactly a household name. It's called Here. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story.
So should I feel bad if I had never heard of Here before today?
Absolutely not.
And neither should you, says Brady Forrest with Highway 1, a hardware incubator in San Francisco.
Nobody outside of the mapping industry has ever heard of Here. It's, in my opinion, kind of a failed attempt at consumer branding.
And yet, it's the biggest rival to Google Maps. Amazon and Microsoft use it. And if you've ever driven a car with a built-in navigation system, some 80% of them use Here's data.
Chances are you've used, and depending on the year, perhaps a cursed at the system.
That's Bryant Walker-Smith, who teaches technology law at the University of South Carolina. Uber wouldn't comment on reports of its interest in Here, but Roger Lonto with Strategy Analytics says the company collects immense amounts of data about driving in major cities and wants to use it to build a logistics and shipping business.
It's a very powerful batch of data, all of which revolves around location. So the more accurate the location you have, the better.
Right now, Uber uses Google Maps, but Google is a competitor, and not just in logistics. Uber also has its eye on a driverless car, as does Google, and so do the German auto companies, also reportedly working on a bid. Again, Brady Forrest.
For driverless cars to work, they need to know where they're going, and for that, they need mapping data.
And no one wants to be dependent on Google for that data. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The National Retail Federation says we're going to spend collectively more than $21 billion on Mother's Day this year. It's Sunday, by the way, for the laggards among you. Some of that $21 billion may well go to Edible Arrangements, the fruit basket company. Tariq Farid is the founder and CEO. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Kai.
I'm going to ask the first question that popped into my mind when I saw one of these things, which was, why?
Why not?
Touché.
You know, I was in the flower business. So yeah. I started a flower shop when I was 17 and been in the flower business 12, 13 years, saw a fruit arrangement and then just started playing around at the flower shop and opened one on the side of the flower shop. And it was just a hit. As soon as we showed it to the customers and we started delivering it, people loved it. And at that point, we're like, why not? Let's just go with it. We started with a tiny, about 600 square foot store, and it took off.
What did you do? Did you go to this, you know, supermarket and buy a bunch of fruit and carve it and cut it up yourself and stick it in the arrangements?
The supermarket wouldn't work because the kind of fruit we were looking for, the taste and look is very important. So I was very lucky to go down to the market and go talk to people that sold fruit. I knew a lot about flowers. I didn't know much about fruit. And it was pretty amazing. They started to tell you what the premium pineapple is, what the premium strawberry is, what seasons and all those things. So I spent the first 6 or 7 months just playing around. And, you know, we had to develop cutting tools. We had to do a lot of things to kind of find out what the base of the arrangement would be, how you have to have food safe baskets that it has to go into.
Oh, yeah, cool.
So it was just a lot of fun. And we started to sell it about March 1999.
You give a lot of credit to your early adoption of technology in helping grow and really sort of catapult this business.
Yes. In the beginning, as you asked why, majority of the people that I went to ask for money, they would probably ask that and they did not think we would succeed. So it was really difficult from trying to get financing from banks. I mean, you would fill in the applications. You would do all the things that needed, but then they would deny you. So as we were growing, you needed a lot of staff. You needed a lot of resources and everything. So we leaned on technology from, you know, what a time for the websites to be coming to life in 1999, 2000, where the web allowed us to handle a lot more customers instead of actually having to have a lot of people on the phone. So from there, we just started to create all different technologies within even the franchise to support our franchisees to be successful. And it's worked very well for us.
When did you know that you were going to make it with this idea?
I think the first Easter in 1999, it was Easter. We sold about 28 arrangements, and it took us all day to make them because we had no tools. We used to cut everything by hand. But customers would call back and say, hey, this was a great hit. Wow, it was amazing. And then they're asking about Mother's Day is coming up. I want to do something for Mother's Day. Because on Easter, we couldn't take that many orders and people wanted to order early. So when you saw that, you knew you were onto something. And even though at that time I started running around to banks and running around to different people to raise money, no one thought we would actually make it.
Giving arranged fruit is quite the example of discretionary income, right? I mean, people don't do this if they need to make the rent. So I want to ask you the economic indicator question, because I imagine during the recession you had a tough time. And what are you looking at now in terms of sort of your short-term forecast?
See, Kai, everybody thinks that. You know, I started in 1999. A year later, the wheels fell off.
Right.
And then in 2008, as the economy, we hit another bump. And this is probably why the banks were having difficulty lending us money in the beginning, because they thought it was discretionary income. People will spend. Birthdays have to be celebrated. Love has to continue. And from that point, people want to send something of value. And nothing is of more value that it looks great and then you can eat it. So it's been a hit. And we, you know, some of our best years were 2008, 2009. So we've done well in the downturn because people are looking for value.
What's biggest for you, Easter or Mother's Day? Or maybe a different one. I don't know.
Valentine's Day and Mother's Day are probably neck and neck.
Valentine's Day? Seriously? People give fruit on Valentine's Day?
Strawberries? Chocolate-covered strawberries? Kai, don't tell me you haven't said chocolate-covered strawberries on Valentine's Day.
Don't even go there. don't even go there. Tariq Fareed, the founder and CEO of Edible Arrangements. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Final note on the way out today, in which Starbucks gets its head out of its coffee grounds. We are having, as you might have heard once or twice, a heck of a drought out here in the West. So Starbucks has decided it's maybe not a great idea to be using California water for its Ethos bottled water brand. Mother Jones Magazine reported a week or so ago that the coffee chain was using private springs up near the Sierra Nevada mountains to source that water. Starbucks said today, we'll use Pennsylvania water for at least the next 6 months on that. Hey, look at the time. We got to go. The Dow, 267 points to the upside today, 1.5%. The NASDAQ up 58 points, about 1.1%. The S&P 500 put on 28 points. That is about 1.33%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Tommy Andres is the acting senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.